You want to, can you tone this light down on me a little bit? Lord, I ask that you be with us tonight, and as we look at this incident in chapters 9 and 10 of Joshua, I pray that you give us not only insight into that, but insight into our own lives when we are dealing with other people and driving in the traffic of the world. And I ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. This is number 17. We're going to be talking about covenants and vows and irregular people in the midst of this story that's in chapter 9 and 10, which has to do with them dealing with a bunch of little city-states. And we're going to notice that each of the cities has its own little king that runs the place. So they're like little kingdoms. And if you look at it like that, then you know what? Every one of us has a little kingdom too, don't we? There are things that you're responsible for. There are things that you're in charge of, in control of. You have your households or whatever. You might have it in a job situation. But you have a kingdom in this world. And your kingdom may be submitted to other kingdoms in terms of things. And if things were to go wrong, then you would have war with them, such as maybe the bank. And the king of the bank and dealing with your life or something, or maybe it's your neighbor that you might have little problems with your neighbors and their kingdom is infringing on yours, and we got that going on right now in the context of the church. And you might as well know about it if you're members of this church. Our neighbor over here decided to requisition about 7 feet of our property and build a fence on it. And we've got to deal with this. So our kingdom is going to go against their kingdom in some form or fashion to figure this out. Okay, so there's lots of little kingdoms. And so when you read this story in chapter 9 and 10 of Joshua, you need to think about the kind of different little kingdom states that we have as well and how we move among one another and all that that means. Okay, so we have to drive in traffic in this world. So each city-state has something. Now, I'm going to read to you chapter 9, verses 1 to 15. Now, this is after Jericho. This is after their fiasco at Ai and then how they actually took Ai when they finally decided to do it God's way. This is after that. And they're moving through the country a little bit, and they come across some little city-states out there. So let me read to you verses 1 to 15, and just kind of walk through it with you. When all the kings who were beyond the Jordan in the hill country and in the lowland all along the coast of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites heard of this, what did they hear of? They heard of how Ai was taken, how Jericho was taken. They gathered together in one accord to fight Joshua and Israel. But when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai, they, on their part, acted with cunning. And they went and made ready provisions and took worn-out sacks upon their asses and wineskins, worn out and torn and mended, with worn out patched sandals on their feet, and worn out clothes, and all their provisions were dry and moldy. Do you see what they're doing? And they went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal and said to him and to the men of Israel, "We have come from a far country, so now make a covenant with us." Let's make a deal. But the men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you live among us. Then how can we make a covenant with you?" They were a little bit skeptical of this group. So they went. They said to Joshua, "We are your servants." And Joshua said to them, "Who are you? Where do you come from?" And they said to him, "From a very far country your servants have come because of the name of the Lord your God, for we have heard a report of him and all that he did in Egypt." Basically, they're sucking up to Joshua and the boys out there. They're just trying to do this kind of stuff And, you know, flattery can turn the mind if it's done right. And all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, who dwelt in Ashtaroth. And our elders and all the inhabitants of our country said to us, take provisions in your hand for the journey, and go to meet them, and say to them, we are your servants. Come now, make a covenant with us. Here is our bread. It was still warm when we took it from our houses, as our food for the journey on the day we set forth to come to you. But now, behold, it's dry and moldy. We've been on the road a long time. These wineskins were new when we filled them, and behold, they are burst now. They're all cracked and dried up. And these garments and shoes of ours are worn out from the very long journey. So the men partook of their provision and did not ask direction from the Lord. Now, this is a key verse right there, by the way. They did not ask direction from the Lord again. And Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore to them. Now, as I said, there are all these little kingdoms around the place. And Gibeon is one of those cities, and it's a kind of strong city amongst them, and they're pretty decent size. But these guys have come, well, let's just couch it in our terms here. They have come to hear from Macon. How many miles is that? 5 to 10? Maybe? That's where they've come from. They've come that short a distance, and they are using trickery here to to talk about this. Now, try and get the Israelites to leave them alone and not hurt them. And so they don't tell them where they're really from. They just kind of play this game with them. Now, these guys are clever. It's a real trip. It's from Macon to Decatur. That's basically what it is. Now, you'll notice that the Israelis were a little bit leery at first. We're supposed to conquer this land, and then all this stuff is going on. And they go through this, and in verse 14, it's the key verse, which is, they did not ask direction from the Lord. Anybody ever know that? That's what they did. In verse 15, you'll notice what they do. They made peace with them. That's the first thing. They made a covenant with them to let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore to them. They made an oath or a vow as well from all the leaders of the people of Israel. That's what took place here. And so the people of Gibeon have this vow that the Israelis and Joshua have made to them. So I want to talk a little bit about covenants and vows, because that's what's going on here. And these are just the people out there in the world. They're people that the Israelis are driving in traffic to them. And so here's what they're doing. Now, a covenant, oath, a vow, these are things that we make to one another on occasion. We will make a promise to somebody. And, well, are you good for your word or not? You know, when I was growing up, my parents' generation especially, there was that, you know, you can get it by with your word and a handshake a lot of times, but that can't happen much anymore. We don't buy into that program as much. But people would make covenants or promises to one another, and you don't break that. You end up being judged on the grounds of your oath. Now, are you good for your word? What kind of covenants and vows and oaths do we make? Well, this weekend there's going to be a women's retreat here. And the theme of this is being the bride of Christ. And one of the things that they're going to do is they're going to have a marriage service at the end. I mean, you know, I've done a lot of marriages. And normally, I do the just one you might see on a soap opera or something like that, basically is what it is. And there are vows and oaths in there. And I want to read them to you because they stand before me. People don't understand this truth. They're not saying the vow to me, but they are saying the vow in front of witnesses. And they are doing it before God because I only do Christian weddings. I don't do civil weddings. I do Christian weddings. And in those instances, God is the authority in those marriages. And so when they're standing before me, they're standing before God. But a lot of people are kind of flippant about this. You know, it says, I so-and-so, it could be the man or the woman, take you to be my wedded wife, and I do promise and covenant. Here are the two words that are there. I do promise and covenant before God and these witnesses to be your loving and faithful husband in plenty and want, in joy and in sorrow, in sickness and in health, as long as we both shall live. That is a covenant. That is a vow. And if you read that vow, it means something. You know, one of the things that we do in this church is we don't make pledges in terms of money like a lot of churches do that. But I started doing this down in Kentucky, I don't know, 30 years ago or so, where we did a faith promise. Now, if you... Those of you who have done the faith promise for this church, you will notice in it that this is a faith promise that you make to God because you don't turn your name in. You may turn an amount in so that we have an idea what's going on, but we never get faith promises more than about half of what our budget is, I don't think, any more than that. But if you read it, it says, with faith in God to provide and trusting, he will enable me to do so, I make the following faith promise. And then there's amounts of money that you can check or you can put in your own amount. That is something that you make before God. Now, granted, we use the monies as part of our operating budget for here to keep the lights on and yeah, and you keep me out of the gutter. But the fact of the matter is that is a vow, a covenant, a promise that you make before God. Now, you know, when those of you, most all of you have joined this church since I've been here. I don't know what other churches do because I learned this a long time ago. We have basically three questions that we ask of people when they join the church. The first two have really to do with the Christian faith, which is, do you see yourself as a sinner in the sight of God in need of his forgiveness? Well, I hope your answer is yes to that. Otherwise, you're deluding yourself. The second question is, do you still accept Jesus as your Savior and plan to make him Lord of your life? And that has to do with the essence of who the Christian is in the sight of God. Okay, those two questions have to do with the faith. The third question that is put to people who join the church is, while you're a member of this church, do you promise to it your loyalty in its worship and its work? That's who we are and what we do. In other words, you say, I submit to the authority and the government of the church and the direction that we're going, that the officers lead us, and what we do. And I pledge that promise to be faithful in worship. Now, you don't make that covenant, that promise, to anyone except that it is heard by God. It's that simple. And the question is, are you good for your word? You know, the thing that has to do with like the faith promise, which has to do with giving. Who's the Lord of your life? Are you the Lord of your life, or is God the Lord of your life? What does that vow entail in terms of who you are? You know, one of the things that we don't, we think that it's the church. I am a firm believer that our involvement and commitment in a church body really has to do with our relationship with God. And then you find a local group where you act that out in terms of things. But what is your commitment to God? Now, these two chapters, 9 and 10 of Joshua, really look at our responsibility, at their responsibility of how they made this covenant with these bunch of conniving guys from Gibeon, who are doing it out of fear as much as anything to get into good graces and to get some kind of a commitment from the people of Israel to keep them from getting killed, understandably, but they were doing it by sleight of hand, by coming into this thing. But they also, we look at the responsibility that Joshua and the people of Israel, their leaders, make in terms of their promise to these people. And that's what we're looking at here. So if we move on here, verses 16 to 21, and I'll just kind of walk through the story with you as we do. These five kings, I've got to start at chapter, I got through 15, right? I'm in the wrong chapter. No wonder I'm having trouble here. Chapter 6, 9. At the end of 3 days, after they had made a covenant with them, they heard that they were their neighbors and that they dwelt among them. In other words, the Jewish people found out, hey, these guys just live about 7 miles from here, and they've pulled a fast one on us. And the people of Israel set out and reached their cities on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon, Chephirah, Beeroth, Kiriath-Jearim, I hope. But the people of Israel did not kill them because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. Then all the congregation murmured against the leaders. Now, the leaders had made a promise, a vow to these people. So when they got there and they found out they were only living 7 miles away, they said, well, we're not going to kill them. And the people murmured against them. They said, what's wrong with our leadership? We ought to take these suckers out like we took out Ai and Jericho and all these others. So they murmured against the leadership because they didn't think that the leadership knew what they were talking about. Then it said in verse 19, but all the leaders said to all the congregation, we have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we may not touch them. In other words, we made a vow, and we are not going to break that vow. This we will do to them, and let them live, lest wrath be upon us. Now, where's the wrath going to come from? It's going to come from God, because they are going to, if they renege on their promise, their vow, their covenant with them, lest wrath be upon us because of the oath which we swore to them. And the leaders said to them, let them live. So they become hewers of wood and drawers of water for all the congregation as the leaders had said to them. Now, Gibeon, one of the things that I've, if you're going to do some Bible study and stuff, it is always good to have a pretty good concordance around with you, one that has translations of these words and what they mean. A lot of times there's some meaning within the context of the names of people and the names of places. Gibeon means hill. Chephirah means hamlet, small village. Beeroth is the word for wells, water wells. And the people that come from there, as we'll find out here, are drawers of water. Kiriath is the forest, forest city. That's what it means. And you'll notice also that some of them were hewers of wood or woodcutters. Okay? So you have, in the context of this, you got people who have wells, water wells, and you have a forest people, forest city, and those become what they do as slaves or servants of the people of Israel. Verses 22 to 27. Joshua summoned them, and he said to them, "Why did you deceive us, saying, 'We are very far from you when you dwell among us'? Now, therefore, you are cursed, and some of you shall always be slaves, hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God." And they draw from those two places in terms of what they do. They answered Joshua, "Because it was told to your servants for a certainty that the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you, so we feared greatly for our lives because of you and did this thing." In other words, they were just afraid of the consequences of not doing something, and if they were to go against them in war, they said, "Hey, if God is with them, we can't defeat them, and we will be destroyed." And so they decided to be sneaky about the whole thing and conniving and all that, and that's what they did. You know, and that's one of the things that drives us in terms of this kind of thinking. Fear. Let me tell you about fear. Fear drives us in such a ways that it can cause us all kinds of, get all kinds of deception in the way we do things. Anyway, "So we feared greatly for our lives because of you and did this thing. And now, behold, we are in your hand. Do as it seems good and right in your sight to do to us." So he did to them and delivered them out of the hand of the people of Israel, and they did not kill him. In other words, Joshua told the congregation, all the nation, he says, "We're not messing with these people. You're going to leave them alone." And they obeyed Joshua. "But Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord to continue to this day in the place which he should choose." Now, what they were doing is they were going to be involved in the worship in the tabernacle and all this. Now, I've talked to you about this, and I'm telling you what, this is the eternal principles here. Water and grain equal grace. In the Bible, just, I don't care where you read about it, you're going to see that's one of the witnesses. Grain or water, that's the one that is the witness of grace. Wherever you see those things, you'll see it. When it comes to the truth, grace and truth, that's what Jesus was full of. Truth is the other witness. And that has to do with wine. It has to do with fire. And that's where you see the truth. And you'll find the truth when you go. Moses went in front of the burning bush, and that was fire, and he was given revelation, truth. Noah was saved, but God drowned him out, and that was grace because he did not destroy the world. He just destroyed the evil that was in the world. Wherever you look, you talk about, you have in the wilderness, they're out there, they have the manna, which is bread that comes down from heaven, but they have the glory cloud out in front of them, which they can see, which is a fire that gave them direction, gave them revelation, truth, the way to go. Grace and truth are the two witnesses. And you have the two witnesses right here again if you look at it. The grace, they are drawers of water and hewers of wood, and you use the wood to build the fires. And so you have water and wood. So you have the two witnesses. And what they said here is that your descendants are going to continue this task from here on out. Now, I'm just walking through the story with you at this point in time. Chapter 10, verses 1 to 5. When Adonizedek, Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, heard of how Joshua had taken Ai and had utterly destroyed it, doing to Ai and its king as he had done to Jericho and its king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them, he feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities. It was a pretty decent-sized group of people. And because it was greater than Ai and all its men were mighty. So Adonizedek, king Adon, of king of Jerusalem, sent to Hoham, king of Hebron, to Piram, king of Jarmuth, to Japhia, king of Lachish, and to Debir, king of Eglon, saying, "Come, come up to me and help me, and let us smite Gibeon, for it has made peace with Joshua and with the people of Israel." Then the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon, gathered their forces and went up with all their armies and encamped against Gibeon and made war against it. In other words, these five cities got mad at Gibeon for getting tied together with the people of Israel, and so they go after them, okay? It's kind of like you can have a couple of families get together and say, "We don't like these people, we're gonna mess with them." And that's what they were doing. And we all have kingdoms. Anybody ever come up against you? Have you ever gone up against somebody? Kingdoms. the names here, I'll give you the names. Adonizedek is the Lord of Justice, and he's in Jerusalem, which is the possession of peace. Hoham is the God, protects the multitude. That's what the meaning of his name. And Hebron is a ford or a place of crossing. Debir is a speaker. And Eglon is the word for circle. Piram is a wild or a roving person. And Jarmuth is a height or a high place. Japha means high. And Lachish means high place. So those guys, that's what their meanings are, okay? So these guys get together and they come up against Gibeon. Verses 6 to 11. And the men of Gibeon sent to Joshua at the camp in Gilgal, saying, "Do not relax your hand from your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us and help us. For all the kings of the Amorites that dwell in the hill country are gathered against us." So Joshua went up from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. There shall not a man of them stand before you." So Joshua came upon them suddenly, having marched up all night from Gilgal. I mean, it's only 7 miles. Okay, and the Lord threw them into a panic before Israel, who slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon and chased them by the way of the ascent of Beth-horon and smote them as far as Azekah and Makkedah. And as they fled before Israel, while they were going down the ascent of Beth-horon, the Lord threw down a great stone from heaven upon them as far as Azekah, and they died. And there were more who died because of the hailstones than the men of Israel killed with the sword. Now, I want you to think about this. Back in verse 14 or 15 of chapter 9, the promises that Joshua made, I want you to see what they were. Joshua made peace with them, that's Gibeon. They made a covenant with them to let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore to them, made a vow that they would abide by that. Basically, that covenant is you can't attack us. You can't kill us, right? That's what Joshua promises. So he says, okay, we won't do that. Now they come and they're asking for help. Joshua doesn't like this at all, but that's the way it is, and they're coming asking for help. And they want you, come and defend us. Now, if you think about this, Joshua could have said, be thankful we don't do it. Take care of yourself. Because all he made was a promise to not kill them, didn't he? He didn't make a promise to defend them at all. At least that's the way I read it. He only made a promise to not be the one who does it. But here, he decides that when they ask for help, that they would go up there. Now, he could have said, no, I'm not coming. We're not coming. You're going to have to take care of yourself. And if these people kill you, well, that ain't all on our backs. But he decides to go and serve these people. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up, in our lives, sometimes we might be the people of Gibeon. Of course, I know you're all just sweet and pure and probably ought to be selling milk, but there might be one among us. It might be like the people getting cunning, trickery, conning people, not telling the truth for whatever reason, trying to use other people. Or you could be God's man or woman in a given situation and you have to deal with somebody that isn't quite on the up and up with you and you know it. In fact, I figured it out, okay? So apply this stuff in the context of our lives. Now, some of this may be going on right now, but sometimes it's things that have happened to us in the past or will happen to us in the future. Joshua decides here to serve these people, even though that's not part of the covenant or the promise. The promise is, we won't kill you. So let me read to you verses 6 to 11 again. And the men of Gibeon sent to Joshua at the camp of Gilead, do not relax your hand from your service. Come up to us quickly to do this thing, to save us. Now, there are three things that come out of this. It starts a string of victories for Joshua and the people. And those string of victories take place through the next couple, three chapters in terms of this. The second thing that happens here is Joshua is actually witnessing to these people by serving them and defending them. It might be that sometimes we end up serving and defending people too that may not be quite on the up and up with us, but it may be a witness to them. He made a covenant with these people. He's keeping that covenant. But in the midst of that, he is actually going that, what they call gospel measure, one step beyond. He's not even killing them, but he's actually helping them to live. Out of this, witness to these people and his involvement with them, he sees the greatest miracle of his life. Now, you got to understand, he's seen some miracles before. I mean, he saw the crossing of the River Jordan. He saw the walls come falling down at Jericho because he did what God said. But here he sees something else, the greatest miracle of his life. And it's the one that we think about a lot when we talk about Joshua. What is it? When the sun stood still. That didn't happen at Jericho. That happens now. Verses 12 through 14. Then spoke Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord gave the Amorites over to the men of Israel. He said in the sight of Israel, "Sun, stand thou still at Gibeon, and thou moon in the valley of Aijalon." And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed until the nation took vengeance on their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Jashar? The sun stayed in the midst of heaven and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. There had been no day like it before or since when the Lord hearkened to the voice of a man. For the Lord fought for Israel. So he witnessed the greatest miracle of his life. Well, how does this happen? You know, science. There's this constant struggle between science and people of religion or faith. And it's like you can't have both. You know, it's either you believe in the things of science or you believe in the things of faith, and you can't have both. Well, I don't have that problem. I've been in both worlds. What I know about science is, science tells you how things work. That's what really the discussion that has to do with all the sciences. If you go in and you look at physics, what is it about? It's all about how things work. You look at chemistry, the same kind of thing. And so it tells you how things work. You know, all the science go into how the worlds came into being, how the universe was created, and all this stuff. What they don't ask is, why am I? You know, in all this vast universe and all the things that I watch on the Discovery Channel and everything that goes with us about this universe and how big and everything it is, there is not one question where they ask, why am I? Why can I even step back from this and observe it? Why can I be such that I can actually ask these questions? Science deals with how things happen. Religion, faith, deals with why things are and why you are in terms of this. And, you know, this is kind of like we know about the laws of the universe, and you can find them because God is a God of order. And buddy, there's all kinds of laws. And one of those laws is gravity. But why is gravity? We were talking about it here. See, I know gravity works because all you have to do is go to high school and boys and girls, and they just drawn to each other. I don't know how that works, but it works. It's gravity. It pulls them together. Gravity pulls things together. Why is there gravity? Not how it works, not that kind of thing, but why? You know, when we read about these miracles in the Bible, and, you know, people want to explain them away. They want to tell you how this really could have happened. If it's for the Bible, you know, how could this really have happened? Well, sooner or later you get down to things like the resurrection of Jesus from the dead after 3 days being in the tomb, and he comes out, and how did that happen? Why? You know, and Lazarus was in the tomb for 3 days. How does that happen? Because his own sister said, if you open that stone, it's going to stink to high heaven when you open it because that boy's been rotten for 3 days in there. and yet there was a resurrection that took place. We read about the Red Sea and the parting of the Red Sea and Moses and all that. And people try to explain how that actually happened. And so I went to seminary and I heard all about that it's not really the Red Sea. It's down on one end of the Red Sea where it's about 3 feet deep. And the winds came up and blew all that water back so those people could get across. At which point you ask the question, well, how did all those Egyptians drown in 3 feet of water? You know, that's what science said. We want to rationalize things away. And science deals with how things happen, but not why we are. How does this happen? The sun stood still. I've even heard kinds of things that people have done some kind of study that there's one day missing in creation, in the universal calendars or something. And I'm going, who cares? You know, but Joshua witnesses the greatest miracle of his life, and he called it. The third thing that happens to start that here is that the kings are humiliated. Now, the kings of the that are in this group really kind of represent the world around us. They're the kings of this world. You know, we have kings all over the place, from little ones to big ones. Small, just your household as opposed to like a nation. Like Putin runs Russia. But I'm here to tell you, you know, I really think that Putin is one of these guys that's full of himself. He thinks he's hot stuff. But I know this much. It don't take nothing to take him out. And it doesn't have anything to do with guns. All it has to do with, you know, something goes screwy in him. He gets cancer, and he dies like that clown down in Venezuela who thought he was God. What happened here is the kings of this world at that time were humiliated because there was a new era of dominion that was coming into the place, and it was God's people who were supposed to be moving into this place. And that's what was going on. And so you need to understand that in our lives, if we are God's people, in our daily lives, we need to understand the truth that we live by the grace of God. And if God is our shield and defender, I wouldn't want to mess with you. And another thing is, you look at this story, it begins with deception. And trickery. And people are acting out of their fears or they act out of their hungers in whatever way they do. And that's what we deal with in terms of our lives too. We do it as much as anybody else, but we act out of our fears or we act out of our hungers. You know, what we really want to get a hold of. And what does Joshua do here? And the people of Israel, and especially his leaders. He stands by his word. Okay? And he serves the covenant that he makes with these people. The second thing he does is he sacrifices his own convenience. Actually, he puts some of his nation, if you think of a nation as one person, he puts his nation a little bit at stake, even though God has told him that they won't be able to stand against you. So he serves the covenant that he made with these people. He sacrifices his own convenience. He goes to war for them. And he ends up with miracles and victories. Let me read to you Joshua 10, verses 12 to 21 again. Then spoke Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord gave the Amorites over to the men of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, Sun, stand thou still at Gibeon, and thou moon in the valley of Aijalah. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed, until the nation took vengeance on their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Jashar? The sun stayed in the midst of heaven and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. There has been no day like it before or since, when the Lord hearkened to the voice of a man. For the Lord fought for Israel. Then Joshua returned, and all Israel with him, to the camp at Gilgal. These five kings fled and hid themselves in the cave at Makkedah. And it was told Joshua, the five kings have been found, hidden in the cave at Makkedah. And Joshua said, roll great stones against the mouth of the cave and set men by it to guard them. But do not stay there yourselves. Pursue your enemies. Fall upon their rear. Do not let them enter their cities, for the Lord your God has given them into your hand. When Joshua and the men of Israel had finished slaying them with a very great slaughter until they were wiped out, and when the remnant which remained of them had entered into the fortified cities, all the people returned safe to Joshua in the camp at Makkedah. Not a man moved his tongue against any of the people of Israel, but he shut their mouths. That's what it says. I'm going to take about 10 minutes to talk to be a little bit about some personal witness here. You know, over the years, I have encountered, dealt with, embraced, and messed with lots of people in terms of ministry. And I've come to this conclusion. Some of them are somewhat subhuman. God loves them, but the rest of us don't think much of them. And now I say that with a little bit of fear because God may love them, but I've met all kinds. So I say that with a little bit of fear. I've dealt with people who I don't like. Didn't like them from the moment I met them, some of them. I've dealt with people in ministry who don't tell the truth, and yet they have appealed to me, and they're either dealing in deception or they're dealing in their own stupidity. I have dealt with people who are, you know, we're kind of like a bell curve, us people. And I don't know if you ever did anything, but this is a bell curve. On one side, you might have really, really good people. These are people who sell milk. And on this side, you have really, really, really bad people, evil people. And then you have everybody else on the bell curve, and all of us fall on this bell curve someplace. And you know the big section in the center of it is probably where most of us are, is that we're something between good and bad, and, you know, we're definitely not perfect or anything like that. But I'm here to tell you, I have met some of these that are really good, and I have run into some really evil people over the years. Now, the thing that I know about that is that I've had to deal with them on all aspects of this. You drive in traffic too. You have people around you. You have different encounters with people in different kinds of situations all the time. And I know that. And I do too. But you know what? I deal with people who deal in rumors and gossip. Ugh. False witness. Lies over the years. Boy, I pray for discernment and wisdom when I'm dealing with people because we all fall in this someplace. And there are some that are over here on this far side where they are not too good. And yet they will appeal to me. And a lot of times it's through deception or they try to take me at stupidity, and they want me to come into agreement with them, covenant with them. You know, we talk about the really bad people in history, like Hitler and maybe Bin Laden or some of these guys, but I'm here to tell you, those are just normal people who got on top of the hill. There are some out there that are just normal people, and they're not on top of the hill, but they're as bad as those guys as well. And one of the things that I've learned is over the years, I deal with people of all kinds, all types. I've run into all types of people. And I've also learned this. I don't make promises if I can avoid it. If you look at Matthew chapter 5, this is where, you know, you have to start living by the Word. And I've learned to live by the Word. In chapter 5, verses 33 to 38, Jesus is talking. And one of the things I say, if you're going to follow Jesus, you ought to listen to what he says too. Again, you have heard it that it was said of men of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. But I say to you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. Now, one of the things that I know about this, we all make promises. We all have to make oaths, but you better be careful when you do it. Joshua makes an oath and a promise here to a group of people that he didn't have all the information on. And so he was deceived. But he kept his promise. In fact, he gave him gospel measure. Have you ever made a promise that you've had to keep? One of the principles that are coming out of this thing, and this is a picture in the Old Testament of God's people who get hoodwinked into being something, and out of that comes victories for them, but initially it was on deception. Number one principle is this, and if you make an oath or a promise, you better stand by it. If you make a vow, you better stand by it. Now, Jesus says, don't make promises, but if you do, do it. Carry through. Even in difficult situations, and even if it's inconvenient. True story. I don't think he would mind. I'll probably end with this. When I was in Western Kentucky, I was there for 23 years. And about 12 to 14 years into that, the church had grown such a place that we needed to get some help in there. We kept growing and kept growing, and I just needed some help. So we went on a search for an associate pastor. And over a period of a year or so, they finally found this guy. Well, he was young, and he came there. And one of the things that he did, which really, really hurt his ministry, he would make promises to people. I'll meet you at so-and-so, or I'll make an appointment with someone, and never show up. And he did this over and over and over again. And I mean, it was irritating to the congregation as a whole because he would make a promise to somebody about something or something, and then he wouldn't go with it. And there's a proverb in the book of Proverbs about clouds with no rain. That's basically what he was. You got the threat of rain or the promise of rain coming in the clouds, but then it never happens. Farmers would understand this. That's what he would do with people. So I finally had to sit him down. And I said, listen, I'm going to tell you something. Your ministry is really, really being hurt here because you make promises to people and you don't follow through. And I pointed out several to him. And I said, don't make promises if you're not planning on carrying through with this stuff. Well, I finally got his attention enough so that he put a sign right on his door. It says, don't make promises. And it was right above the light switch. because he would do it. And then he would not follow through on things. And finally, I got to him and I said, don't make promises. And I mean, it was terrible. So he made it, he put the sign up, and so he says, then after that, I had to go in and talk to him. I says, occasionally you have to make a promise. So when you make one, just make sure that you follow through on it. Don't make them unless you're going to do that. Well, I learned this early in my ministry in Western Kentucky. You all get the newsletters? Read the next one. I thought it was good. But anyway, I wrote in the newsletter about it through 2 or 3 months after I got there. I said, my promise is I really want to get around to see all of you in a year. Well, I actually was tried to follow through on that. But you know what? There's always somebody you miss. 5 to 8 years into this thing, this woman made her point with me because I did not get by to see her in that year. I learned a lesson. Don't make promises unless you plan to keep them. And when I was dealing with that, I said, you know, I had every intent of trying to cover the entire congregation, but, you know, sheep move around, and they keep moving around, and you can't always keep it. Plus, I didn't take a checklist to do all this, and she took me at my word. And I didn't get that done, at least not with her. Now, 95% of the people I probably got to see, but they probably didn't care anyway. This is about making promises. Joshua and the leaders made a promise to these people, and they followed through on it. I'm gonna stop here. We're going to pick up right here in terms of this story, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about promises and covenants and dealing with people. You know, and we deal with all kinds of people. And people fall all over this bell curve. And we drive in traffic, folks. Now, I'm assuming that all of you are falling over here someplace on this end of the curve. Actually, I'm not assuming that at all. I'm just trying to trick you, deceive you. But I would like for that to be true. But if it is, you still deal with people. And if you're going to be God's man or woman in this world, you need to be straight up, so to speak, in terms of this kind of thinking. So we'll call it a day. Now, next week, I won't be here next week. So we're going to try something a little bit different. You know, this right now ministries that we have access to as a congregation, and if you've never used it, I would suggest that you use it. I knew I was going to be gone next week, and so I went in there, and they got some really good speakers that do Bible studies and things. So we're going to do a Bible study next week on the times of our lives. It's really about Psalm 90. So if you want to plan for it and study it, take a look at Psalm 90, and the guy that's going to be doing it is Andy Stanley, and he speaks to a lot more people than I do. And it's about 40 minutes long. The rest of the time, we're going to take a little bit of time for Michelle to lead us in worship here, since I'll be gone next week. So we'll do that, and we'll pick up on this stuff in 2 weeks. So next week will be it's a commercial, but it also works. If you like this one that he does next week, you go into this website, and this particular study has got 6 of them in it, and it's about the times of our lives and how we deal with time and priorities and things like that. And the first one is good because it doesn't assume that you've seen the rest of the stuff. So let's pray. Lord, I ask that you would help each of us to live this life and to be true in our promises and our covenants and to be smart as well as your people so that we can be good witnesses to your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.